evening, everyone. Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm Pam Stack, your host. I'm so glad you're with me tonight because I'm going to bring you another nasty woman from our Female Crime Fiction Thriller Writers Month. Don't go away because I want you to meet Terry Shames and a special guest. Much for being with me tonight here on Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, and I want to give a shout out and a Happy New Year to my friend Robert Gregory Brown, who is a very fine suspense author. He's also a very talented playwright and musician. He created and plays our theme music. I haven't said thank you for a long time, so thank you, Rob. With me tonight on another, this is just, it's wonderful. It's book release day for my guest, and I'm so happy. Terry Shames is a McCavity Award-winning author. She writes the Samuel Craddock series. Her new book, An Unsettling Crime for Samuel Craddock, is due out today, so you can go right now. Hurry up, go right now to Amazon, and you can pick up that book. Now, with me also on this show, and I'm loving this, I get to sit back and have the benefit of two fantastic authors speaking to each other. My friend Rob Brunet, who is also a writer, has decided to join us. He's going to be the guest co-host, but he's really going to go ahead and host. Rob, how are you?
Wonderful. So happy to be here so thrilled that I didn't have to arm wrestle to get to interview Terry Shames, though I was willing to.
Oh, please. You know I would never make you do that. But let me tell folks a little bit about you. You're a creative writing instructor at George Brown College, and you're the co-host of Noir in the Bar, Toronto. You're also a member of Sisters in Crime, and you're the RVP Toronto and Southwest Ontario Crime Writers of Canada. So thank you so much for being with me. And, of course, our very special guest tonight is the absolutely delightful and devilish Terry Shames. Terry, welcome back to Authors on the Air. I can't tell you how thrilled I am that you're here.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
And congratulations on the release of book number 6 in the series. My gosh, woman, you're going to take up all the shelves. You're going to have a whole shelf to yourself on my bookcase.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. 6 seems like a lot to me, but then I look at some other authors and I think, well, I'm just barely getting started.
Well, and you might just be barely getting started. But in the meantime, let's talk a little bit about you. I want to just share that you grew up in Texas on the Gulf Coast and went to Brazos Fort High School, which we talked about that before. And you were heavily involved in theater, acting, directing, and the chorus, which I love because that just shows you have so many creative sides to you. And so you kind of based Jarrett Creek, where the setting for your Samuel Craddock books are, kind of on the town where your grandparents were, correct?
Yes, it's in Central Texas. It's if you threw a dart and hit the center of Texas, that's where it is.
How wonderful. Well, in the meantime, I know we talked about this before, but you did join the CIA, and you were a computer programmer analyst, which is something my brother does, and I still don't understand. I also don't understand how you can use both your left and your right brain and be so fantastically fun to be around. So congratulations on those. I'm going to turn this interview over to my guest host, Rob Brunet, who wants to talk to you about writing and all things mysteries. How about it, Rob? Terry is now yours.
Thanks, Pam.
Hi, Rob.
Terry,
you're welcome.
Hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm really happy to be talking with you.
Well, me too. It was, I don't know, probably like 3 weeks ago that I sent you an email saying I wished you were down the street and I could have a coffee. And then next
I
thing
know,
I knew,
really.
I was getting, I found out I get to do this. So tickled pink, I think, is what they say when they're using old phrases. and the whole idea that that this is part of Nasty Woman Month, I think it's just terrific, because anyone who's seen your picture and certainly anyone who's spent 3 minutes speaking with you knows you're about as unnasty as they come, though you're able to find the nasty in your writing. So I'm just buzzed to be able to talk to you.
Yeah, but the other thing is,
congratulations
that
on the book.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah.
And you're getting a lot of immediate buzz on the launch, too.
You know, I just couldn't believe some of the wonderful reviews that I've gotten today from you know, that have just happened to come in today, because it's launch day, some of the reviews come in, and there are a couple that really, I really feel like they got what I was after in the book.
Do you want to let us know one?
Well, one is...
Because I'm going to drag one up in a minute if you don't.
Lisa Holstein was gave me one that was just wonderful, and Drew Ann Love always gives me a nice review, and the other one is Kathy Real Boone. She just wrote a fabulous review. Yeah, those three. I mean, those came in today, and I was just so grateful that they seemed to understand what the book was about.
So. I'm in the middle of the last death of Jack Harbin, so I do not yet know what
An
Unsettling Crime for Samuel Craddock is about. So why don't you tell us what it's about?
What the new book is about?
Yeah.
It's an unsettling crime for Samuel Craddock, and the reason it unsettles him is that he has just become, this is a prequel set in the early 80s, and he has just become the new chief of police. He's been hired for reasons that he's told that it's just to kind of ferret out some drug things, and he's a young man, and they think that because it's a drug-related thing with young people that he maybe would be able to understand it better. And the old chief of police is just retiring, so he said he would do it, and his wife is not happy about it. They've just been married 6 years, and she doesn't really like the idea of him doing this, but he went ahead and did it without consulting her. And it turns out that there are some ulterior motives why he was asked by the city council to be the chief of police, and he'll find that out later. But this big case that comes in, right, he's only been a chief of police for 6 months, and a horrendous thing happens. Five people are found dead in a house that's been burned down, and one of them is they realize was shot trying to escape. And I mean, as horrendous as it is, he's just horrified by it. It turns out he is not actually responsible for investigating, but when the wrong person is arrested, he decides that he has to take matters into his own hands, and that's basically what is going on. In the course of it, you find out who Samuel is, how he confronted himself as a brand new chief of police, as a young man who didn't know exactly what he was up to, and how he becomes who he is in later books.
That's interesting. So I believe the first one that I read, it was the second in the series, at which point he's retired. But is he actually also retired in the first one?
In the first book?
In the first book? In the series?
In the first book, he's retired. The very first book, A Killing at Cotton Hill, he's retired and has not been a policeman for many years. He actually had another career altogether as a landman in the oil and gas business. And he works with his brother-in-law. And he's done that for many years. He did not want to really be a chief of police. And when this book comes, when the first book is set, he is in his early 60s. His wife has just died. He's kind of unsure what to do with himself. And one of his old friends is murdered. And he, because the town, the chief of police is now the town drunk. decides he needs to find out who did this. And eventually, in the third book, he becomes chief of police again for a very funny reason, because the town goes broke and they can't afford to pay anybody, and he can afford to do it without being paid, so he says he'll do it again.
So thematically, you've got this guy who simply cares too much to be able to shrug his shoulders and walk away when things are wrong, and he keeps getting pulled back in by both the people in the town and the nastiest crime is. I mean, I think that in The Last Death of Jack Hardman, part of it even seemed to be that people were shrugging their shoulders and saying, like, if you don't find out, the guy you'll have to try isn't going to be able to do it.
Yeah.
So I love that. So with an unsettling crime, you're setting him up as someone who knows that if he is going to make a difference, he's going to get involved, whether or not it's on his badge, sort of thing.
Yes, exactly. Well, it's partly because he really is absolutely certain that the man who was arrested, who is a black man, could not have done this. And he feels like he knows that the guy's going to be railroaded. And in fact, when I first conceived of this book, it was based on a real case that happened in that small town. But it happened in the 90s, and I just took the kernel of it as the book I wanted to write as a prequel. And I looked up, this is such a crazy coincidence, because just before I started writing, I said, you know, I don't want to make it too much like the old case. So I should look and see what happened. It turned out that a few years ago, that the man who was arrested and convicted of the crime and had spent 18 years in jail had just been freed by the Innocence Project. So, I mean, it was just such a coincidence because, you know, I don't have this man arrested and jailed, but I did want Samuel Craddock to be instrumental in making sure that he did not get convicted of the crime, because he thought he was innocent.
Yeah. So that's what leads Publishers Weekly, when they gave you a starred review for it, to say it's a timely story with resonance in the air of Black Lives Matter.
Exactly. Well, there's more to it than that. There's also some police corruption involved, and it's just it is a timely book. And I did not, you know, I've been thinking about this book for 3 years. And at the time I started conceiving of it, it didn't seem as timely as it does now. I think it is timeless in terms of, don't get me started on politics, but it's timeless in terms of political problems around race and bigotry and racism and that kind of thing. It's a timeless problem.
Yeah. And yet, so you're writing novels that are engrossing, they're entertaining. You immerse us in Jarrett Creek, and yet you're as with any piece of crime fiction that's done well, I think you're also sort of peeling back the human condition, warts and all, and having us take a look at it. How do you end up balancing that when you're dealing with something that you just said you thought about it for years, you wrote it, you knew that it was a serious issue, and yet you're trying to entertain us while you write about it? How do you balance that?
Well, there are a couple of things. Number one, I think that in all of life we have moments where things are very serious, and then there are moments of lightness. And I have a character named Loretta who always comes in, and she always has a little, she's kind of like, to me, the voice of the community. And she's sometimes a little flaky and says funny things, But there, she's not unkind, and I think that that's the way you have to do it. You can't, if everything is just completely grim all the way through, it can be tedious. Even in some of the Scandinavian mysteries that can be very grim, you'll have these moments of lightness that just make you burst out laughing because that's life. You know, in life,
yeah.
if you know, it isn't interesting to hear a story that's all gloomy. It's interesting to hear a story that has depth to it and roundness to it. So I don't know. That's the way it comes out for me. And I mean, you read Craig Johnson or C.J. Box or Deborah Crombie. There are always moments of lightness in all of their books. Unlike the book that you wrote that is hilarious all the way through, and yet it has a serious subject at the heart of it. So, you know, there are different ways to approach it, but it's one reason I love to not just write but to read crime fiction because these days most crime fiction is so well written and so meaty that you can get all of your social interest, your social kind of experience through reading some of these books.
Yeah. No, I totally agree.
That's a long answer.
No, I think it's a good one. I want to ask you about something that I was struck with as soon as I saw the cover, and maybe it's too obvious, but maybe there's somebody else out there asking themselves the same question. You've got the first five books. They've got the brilliant, blue, stunning Texas sky. They're gorgeous covers. And then this one is also stunning, but in a completely different way. And in fact, probably because I had just read the title, I wrote that I found that it was an unsettling cover, and
mm-hmm.
it is. It's dark. Is there a reason behind that? Did you give a poke to make it happen that way, or did it just does it reflect the nature of the story? Or
well, here's the interesting thing to me. I have always loved my covers, but with the very fifth one, I said, you know, I'm a little tired of this same look. Well, of course, because marketing people feel like everything always
yeah.
has to look the same. It's always been the same kind of cover, and I've liked them a lot. They've been terrific.
Yeah.
The one with a cow on it is one of my favorite
yeah.
covers ever. Every single cover has been terrific. But when I wrote this book, I felt that it was a different kind of book. It was darker, and certainly I handle serious subjects in my books, every one of them. Like you're reading Jack Harbin, to me that was
yeah.
a very serious book. And the cover is darker than the other ones. But I also think the one with the cow on the cover, the Bobtail Ridge, is another book that's very serious. There are serious issues at the heart of it. All of a sudden, I've always had the same book cover designer, and all of a sudden a woman wrote to me and she said, I'm your new cover designer and I think it's time for a little departure. And she sent me this cover and she said, what do you think? And I was just blown away. I said, I absolutely
yeah.
love it. To me, it really reflects the depth of the story. It reflects how, you know, it's a departure because it's a prequel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they'll do with the next cover. They may just continue with the blue and the green and all of that for the next one. I don't know. I'm not asking because
right.
I am really happy with my cover designers with 7th Street. So, you know, I don't have any complaints about that at all.
I totally agree. They are terrific, and the fact that they hang together, I totally understand that from a marketing standpoint. But it's not like they don't look like they're just stamped in. It's just that they share that
right.
beautiful Texas
right.
sky, and then something else is in the foreground, and whatever's in the foreground is always really interesting. Not unlike your titles, which have, I mean, there's always a hook right there on the cover of the book. The one I love the most, which I have not read, but I can't I can't not read a book that's called The Necessary Murder of Noni Blake.
I know.
I mean,
exactly.
It's a murder, yeah, and it's necessary, yeah. Okay, I got it. I sort of have to know why, don't I? I'm not asking you to tell me because then I'll, you know, then I'll be upset that you blew it for me. But anyway, so those, and I think I read somewhere that once you started with a long title, that people wanted them. But do you, where in the process as you're writing a book does the title come out? Because these are good titles.
Well, that's really nice of you to say. The titles have absolutely driven me crazy because the first title, I don't know where it came from. I just decided to call this little town Cotton Hill, and it seemed like a good title. And then they said, oh, they all have to be that way, you know, now that you've set this pace. Well, let me give everyone a little warning. If you think you're going to write several books, when you're going to go to a conference and they say, you know, you can send us your bio but only use 50 words, if your titles are 10 words long, it takes it up really fast. I wish I'd called them number one, number two. No, I love the titles too, and it's interesting because the one I'm working on now, they want the titles really early. And I decided what I wanted to be, and they said, no, this is not exactly right. And I said, well, this is what, you know, I really like it. And they said, okay. You know, I think 7th Street has been very, very responsive. I'm very happy with them.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I've heard that about them from other authors, too. They sound like a terrific shop.
Yeah.
I want to shift gears a little bit with something, and this picks up. It picks up on something that you actually wrote in a blog post, but I'm thinking, Pam, are you still on the line there? I think she might. No, she isn't. Okay, so I'm going to keep on going here. Sorry.
No, I'm here. I'm just listening. I'm sitting here listening to this and saying, wow, I got to write down some of these questions and all that for the next time. I'm here. Yes. What can I do for you?
It's okay. I'll just keep right on going. I was going to ask about, hashtag first time guest host. Okay. I wanted to ask you, Terry, about empathy. And you used the word sympathy in a blog post that I read when you're talking about sympathy that you had for one of your characters that had committed a crime.
Right.
And it's that line between sympathy and empathy. And I wondered how you approach that as a writer, because the characters, very often the characters that are doing the bad things in your books are part of that same community, and they have friends
right.
and relatives
right. yeah.
and they're there. So how do you, it's not like they're coming, they can be some cardboard cutout evil coming in from the outside, which is never really a good story anyway. But more than that, you're writing about people who have empathy for the bad guys in your story. How do you get around putting yourself into their feelings, if I can ask it that way? Does that make sense?
I don't know exactly. I'm not exactly sure what you mean. I feel I'm looking at everything through Samuel Craddock's eyes. And he is a man who has had a lot of distress in his life. When he was young, he had a lot of distress in his life, and he understands that people behave in ways that are not useful to them. He sympathizes with the fact that they have worked themselves into a corner somehow. I don't know how he's going to sympathize with or empathize with the characters in the books I'm writing. The book I'm writing now, that's going to be difficult. I'm curious to know how that's going to work out, and I don't know how it's going to work out.
Okay, so but do you then? Does he as a character? Does he sort of guide you through that? Like, he's certainly guiding me as a reader through that.
Let me tell
that,
you something. Let me tell you a story that I actually, it's going to be in a blog before too long, but I think I'd like to tell the story because it's something that was, it really changed my life. I adored my grandfather, and he's sort of the basis for this whole thing. I was staying with my grandparents, and something terrible happened, and an elderly black man sort of went crazy and went running down the street with no clothes on. And, I mean, I was a young kid. I was maybe 8 or 9, so my grandfather came in, and he told us what happened, and he ran into the police station, grabbed a gun and shot the deputy in the leg and then ran off into the woods. You know, he had just lost it for whatever reason. Well, then my grandfather said, they're going to get a posse together to go after this man. And I was so excited. You know, you think about posses, you think about the Wild West and everything. And I said, oh, and my grandfather was a big man and a strong man and a self-made man. And I just felt that he just could do anything. And I said, are you going with him? And he looked at me, and his eyes were this incredible blue. And he just looked at me, and he said, no, I'm not going. Poor old fella. I've never forgotten that moment where he had empathy for this man that was, I don't know whether it was deserved or not. You know, I have no idea. I don't know the man. But what he was saying is that he could put himself into this man's place momentarily and see that whatever had happened to him, he was frightened. He was going to be probably shot and killed. He was running for his life. And my grandfather... So, yeah, he had done something wrong, but there was a moment of sympathy or empathy for this man. So, yeah. I think the difference in empathy and sympathy is empathy, you can put yourself in someone's place. Sympathy, you may look from the outside and have some understanding of what's going on with them.
Rob and Terry,
exactly.
I want to take just a second, and I'm going to, sorry to interrupt you. This conversation is so exceptional. I'd like to open up the phone lines to have other people call in, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So for callers, you should know this number by now. It's 347-633-9609. The first person who calls in is going to get a copy of Terry's new book, An Unsettling Crime for Samuel Craddock, which is getting rave reviews from all the big critics, never mind from the readers, too, who are also raving about it. So give us a call at 347-633-9609. And I want to remind everyone that this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. One deep breath. And it's back to you, Rob and Terry. Thank you. Back to you.
Thanks. Well, yeah. So I'll simply bracket that really good story, Terry, with the fact that you did a better job of posing and answering the question than I did in trying to frame it. That's exactly what I was looking for, and it's that because you're writing about you're writing about people who have, for whatever reasons, found themselves in a situation which they do something which I, as a reader, may not, may never find myself in that situation, would hope that I would act differently, and yet you manage to make me understand the why of them doing it. It works well. You mentioned your grandfather is and the town. Is he showing up in Sam Craddock?
Yes, for sure. Although,
and
my sister said, you know, our grandfather was not that nice. He was a very rough and ready kind of a guy. He only went through the third grade, and his mother I heard the story from his older sister that his mother used to come and just pick him up and take him off with her wherever she was going. And as his older sister said, she's been long dead, she said they would come up in the buckboard and say, "Sam, get in." And she said, "Of course, he's in the third grade. What does he care about going to school?"
Yeah.
But he was a very smart guy, and was self-educated. He read constantly, and books were so important to him, and I would give anything if he knew that I had written books and published them. He would have been so delighted.
That's yes. Well, so you kind of get it. You kind of, to some extent, writing about Sam Craddock, get to spend some time with him, presumably.
Yes. Oh, for sure. Yes. Okay. Well, Sam Craddock.
Have you ever?
Go ahead.
Sorry. Go ahead. No, I was just going to ask if you haven't. Have you taken him out of Texas yet?
No, I actually thought about taking him to California because he loves California art, as I do. That means, you know, it made total sense for him to be someone who cared about California art. But you know, I had two ideas for books where Samuel would go out of Jarrett Creek and do other things, and I realized that I felt empty without the town. The town itself is a major character for me. All of the people in the town, I pepper it with people that are real to me. It's just amazing to me when I think about this town. I can see where people live. It's not really the exact town, but it's a version in my head of the way the town is.
Well, and it's got this sort of a wholesomeness to it, and I struggled as I put notes together for this question to avoid saying simple country life, because I've spent a fair amount of time in the country too, and I know that the perception of simple country is as false as they can be, because crime happens everywhere and people are people wherever they are.
Exactly.
And complexity is about people, not about a subway map. you seem to use that to sort of juxtapose the crimes that Sam Craddock deals with. And it's almost like, there's a couple of cases or situations where I've seen that he's like shielding town members from the reality of what's happened, whether it's a grisly crime scene or some fact that he says,
mm-hmm.
"Well, I know that, but she doesn't have to, because that will taint her impression of whatever." Is that part of what the town is useful for in terms of revealing his approach as a character?
Yes, it reveals the fact that he is a caretaker. You know, he feels like this town is his to take care of, they still call him chief because he's always been the chief of police for them, even when he wasn't. They call him that because they felt like, this comes directly again from my grandfather, who was the mayor of town. And I was startled once as a child when someone came to ask my grandfather for help, and I asked my mother what that was about. I said, why did this man come and ask Popo that? And he said, she said, well, he used to be the mayor, and he's known to be very fair, and people come to him sometimes when they can't deal with a problem themselves, and he will go and talk to whoever it is and deal with it. And I was amazed. I had no idea that was that was going to be the case, but that's who he was. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and it reflects it reflects well on him. You mentioned the art a couple minutes ago. So you like the so are we getting a peek at your art collection when we hear what Sam's got on his walls?
Ha. Don't I wish? No, you're looking at my fantasy art collection.
If I can interrupt you,
have a caller on from area code 270. Would you like to take that?
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's find out who's calling in. Hello, caller. You're live on the air with Terry and Rob. Go right ahead.
I'm delighted to be here. This is Kathy Rioff here.
Oh,
how
Kathy, hi.
Week. This call is, or, hey, your program is tonight. My Kentucky Wildcats are playing basketball. And I'm listening to this program and have it on mute. So this is how important you are to me. But I'm glad that you liked the review. It is not a complete review that I have on there yet. I started writing and I thought I need to get this up today because I love Samuel Craddock so much. I love this book so much and all of the books in the series. And I have to have something up today, whether I'm finished with my review or not. So it's not actually a complete review that I put up today, but it's enough that I got the gist of things going.
Well, let me tell you this. I really appreciated it. I think it's a wonderful review. So I would.
Very much. There will be just a little bit more to it. But I get carried away and I can't stop. But I was lucky enough to binge read Terry's books this last year. I met her at BoucherCon Raleigh in 2015, and so then I had to read her books in what I'll call my series catch-up reading that winter, and in January and February I caught up on them all, and I love Samuel Craddock. He's just I'm a groupie for Samuel.
A groupie,
as many women are, let me tell you, and some men too. But I think this book is very important, and you all were mentioning the Black Lives Matter, and it's something that a lot of us have being a Caucasian, a lot of us don't particularly understand, or we haven't grasped the importance of Black Lives Matter instead of All Lives Matter, White Lives Matter. But reading Terry's book and reading an Unsettling Crime for Samuel Craddock, and reading another book that I just read two books ago called Darktown by Thomas Nolan.
Right, that's on my list.
You will get off the phone and start reading. But it really, if anything, I will recommend these two books if anybody wants to understand the phrase Black Lives Matter.
Kathy, can I mention another book to you? If you haven't read Attica Locke's book, Pleasantville, you really should. It won the Harper Lee Prize, and it is a fabulous book.
I will put that down, and I may have to ask you, text you later or message you if I don't remember it. But this is something that it's like in the book takes place, Darktown takes place in 1948, and then we have some 40 years later or 20 years later after the Civil Rights Act, we have Samuel Craddock dealing with these same issues of people of color being victimized and taking in for crimes that there is little or no evidence they committed, but they want a scapegoat, and so they grab a person of color, and that this is still happening then, and then we still 30 years down the line from that, we're still dealing with this problem, and it is something that that people of color of Black people and Latinos and all people of color really have, but especially Black Lives Matter. This is something that has been an ongoing problem, even though we think that we should be beyond it now. We're not beyond it. And your book and Darktown, and now you've given me Pleasantville, that I'm going to read those. I think I'm probably going to do a blog post on reading these books to understand, to gain some understanding. But you've written, and you always do. You always deal with important issues. And we come away with you know, understanding, more understanding, which, you know, reading is all about seeing other points of view and understanding issues that we wonder about that are being discussed. And then, but then again, you did say you have the light moments, which you do. And, you know, I love all the minor characters that are in your book too. And I want to go have the goodies that, now I'm going to forget her name. I want to say Laverne. It's not Laverne.
Loretta.
You know, Loretta. Why did I want to say Laverne? Loretta Texas Samuel. You know, because in fact, I think I said one time, I don't know who I really would want to marry the most. Go to Jarrett Creek and marry the most, Samuel or Loretta. You know. It's just, you know, you do have
funny.
Those light moments, and we need, you know, in our life in general, we need those light moments along with the dark moments, and to understand and appreciate life. But I want to thank you for writing this series and giving us something to look forward to every year to Samuel Craddock. And Terry is, I'm sure you all know by now too, just one of the best people to talk to and well connected, because she goes into restaurants and sits down with Carlos Santana.
I know. Isn't that something else, right?
You know, she's very well connected, so I'm
Kathy, thank you so much for calling.
Well, I enjoy.
Thank you for calling, Kathy.
It's
been a joy to have you on the show. She's so full of energy. That's wonderful.
I know, really. She always is.
I'm very enthusiastic about Terry and her book. So anyway, thank you all, and it's a great show. Thank you. Nice.
Happy New Year. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you.
Wow. How wonderful to have someone who loves your books that much.
A
congratulations
real fan.
On that.
A real fan.
Really, truly. I want to ask you both a question as I'm sitting back here listening to this wonderful conversation and scribbling notes as I'm going along, because Rob is talking to you as another author. But, you know, Kathy brought up a lot of very salient points. So my question to each of you is, you know, what do you think the role of fiction is in society today? Because, you know, a lot of people are kind of snooty about only reading nonfiction. I'm not intelligent enough to understand it, and it doesn't hold my attention that well unless it's about, you know, an artist that I'm familiar with or something. I really love genre fiction, but a lot of people don't. They don't care for it. So let me ask you first, Rob, since you've been the one asking the questions, let me have you answer one. What do you think the role of fiction is in society today?
I guess for me, it always starts with entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're asking somebody to spend a considerable number of hours entering an imaginary place that you create for them. And it may be more or less imaginary, depending on the way that you write it. I did not know that I was reading a lot of genre fiction when I didn't know that the label for the books that I was enjoying was genre fiction. But I also enjoy a lot of books that would be classified as literary or would be classified. I mean, there was a time when I was reading a fair amount of speculative fiction before it was called speculative fiction.
It's
always been. Well, yeah, exactly. For me, it was sci-fi. And then when I heard spec, I thought spec was something else. But there have been times in my life where I've been a slow reader, but I have never not had a novel open since I was, you know, whatever, 7 or 8 years old and started reading Encyclopedia Brown or something like that, something
mm-hmm.
before that,
wow.
And then Encyclopedia Brown.
Awesome.
So you finish one, you put it down, and very, very often you know, if I was reading at night, I would close a book and, well, I'm not tired yet, so go pick up another book. And then you start reading
right.
it, even if it took a long time to move from one to the next. So as a writer, I feel like it's a privilege to be able to have someone pick up something that I write and spend time with it and enter that place. At the same time, it's not like I'm trying to bring a heavy message to what I'm writing, but I'm hoping that if I get to sit down with a reader of something that I've written and they say whatever they have to say about it, that I can actually enter another conversation about what the story was about in terms of the context where it sat. So in other words, if it's a simple story about, I mean, like I write some flash fiction, and if it's a simple story about, you know, someone killing themselves in an arbitrary fashion, there's probably some other reason that I wrote it, that, you know, this is what can happen when you are living alone and disconnected from people for whatever, you know, whatever reason. But at the end of the day, if I spend my time sort of beating that drum, I don't think people are going to read what I write. I don't know if that's an answer, but that's there's something underneath the entertainment.
So let's turn that over to you. You know, you have some very hot-button social issues that go on in your books. There's no doubt about it. We just had this lovely conversation with your reader friend, Kathy, who mentioned that. And, of course, PW actually mentioned it in their review for you, their starred review for you.
Yep.
So
yep.
What do you think fiction means to society today? What is its role, if it actually has one, beyond entertainment, as Rob has stated?
Well, I think that the continuing role of fiction is to teach people about what it is to be a human. And that sounds, it's like a high-flown way of saying it, but in fact, it goes back to what Rob was saying about being empathetic or sympathetic. You can read fiction to understand other people. I'll give you an example.
Yes.
I have read Anna Karenina a couple of times, and I tried to read it again. I hate that book. I cannot
right.
tell a lie. It drives me crazy, and I keep going back to it because I think I want to understand what's going on with this woman. And I think that's the reason we read a lot of things, is to those of us who read fiction are trying to understand the world we live in and the people in it. I read everything. I read all kinds of things, not just fiction, not just genre fiction. I read science books. I read math. I read everything. I love everything. I've just got that kind of inquiry that just goes on constantly. But I'm sitting
well,
here.
You have that left and that right brain. That's why.
Exactly.
You know,
I do.
You're one of those rare people that is not only brilliant creatively, but brilliant from, you know, an IQ standard. So a standpoint. So,
I wouldn't
no wonder,
say brilliant.
I think I would. And
I have
think
friends
Rob
that are
would
much
agree with
smarter
me.
Than me.
I think
well,
so.
That
yeah.
doesn't make you
no.
any less brilliant than who you are. But your observation is really, I think, quite astute because, yes, we do read to find out about others. And it's interesting that you say that. So what have you learned, Terry, about yourself since you became a pretty well-known author? What have you learned about you?
Oh God, it's not necessarily good. I love attention.
That's okay.
That's one thing I've learned.
The accolades.
Wait a minute.
Listen, the accolades are part and parcel of the long hours that you spend slaving over a hot laptop. So really, that's okay.
No,
you can.
Thank you.
I
hadn't thought of it that way, but you're right.
I've spent hours and hours. I can justify anything. You just whenever you feel bad, just call me. I'll fix it. Don't worry. but there, you know, I think in you have a chosen profession, as does Rob, as do I, and we're getting something from our chosen professions. We're learning what our strengths and weaknesses are. I mean, I certainly have been slapped into my back into place and have learned some of my strengths and weaknesses. What did you learn about you as an author, other than the fact that you like the attention? And there's nothing absolutely wrong with that. Cripe, you're bloody honest, at least, Terry.
I'll tell you something else that I've learned about myself, and that is that I, at my core, I'm a serious person. And what I've always been someone who likes to laugh, and I love to make people laugh, and I like to be lighthearted, and I have that affect. But at core, I really am very serious, and I take things seriously, and I like to explore serious issues. And
how did you find that out about you? Was it through your writing and your themes of that you write about?
Well, when I look back at these books, I said to myself, you know, I'm talking about things that are very serious to people, and hoping that people get the seriousness of it, not just the entertainment of it. I agree with Rob.
Fantastic.
We have to entertain. Otherwise, who wants to read anything?
I
read things if I read popular science, it has to be done by someone who knows how to write and knows how to make a story out of it. You know, we're storytelling people. We like to listen to stories.
You are absolutely right.
Well, it's like
Pam,
when you said about having a hard time reading sometimes reading nonfiction, I'm right there with you. But I won't be able to cite any, but there are more and more creative nonfiction writers, people who say, okay, I'm going to write nonfiction, but I'm going to bring the creativity to it so that people can, you know, better appreciate the true story that I need to tell them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly.
I agree with you, and I've been so blessed that, you know, something comes across my desk from a publisher, and I think, oh, this is a very compelling story, and I want to read it, and I want to talk to the person who wrote it. So you're right. It is not my go-to place. That's the side that fills my brain. The other side is for my creative. The reading fiction fulfills my creative part, the part of me that loves to imagine and daydream and things like that. So, but what about you, Rob? What have you figured out about you that you didn't know before you started writing?
Perhaps the best answer that I can give is just how much I love getting to know people and their stories, and I have always known that about myself, where I used to wonder why I would be in a social setting and be quiet and yet not be unhappy to be there. I've learned that it's because I just absolutely love sponging when people are really talking, right? When they're really telling you about themselves and what matters to them.
Right.
I just love sponging that up, and I'm slowly learning that I can then go and start jotting it down in a pad somewhere.
Oh, that's so cool.
I'm interested
in the observation of human beings interacting is very important to you. I think that's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm naturally an outgoing person, but I too like to kind of take a step back and watch as people collaborate or people meet for the first time and begin conversations. To me, that's a lot of fun too. So I understand where you're both coming from. We are down to our last seconds.
in this magnificent show. I can't tell you when I've enjoyed a show more. It's been a lot of fun to have both of you here. But I want to ask you each one last question. And I want to, first of all, Rob, please tell everyone where people can find you on the web.
Oh, just at my name, robbrunet.com, B-R-U-N-E-T. And then same thing on Facebook and Twitter. That'll find me, too.
Okay, and you have a lovely little blog post, too, that all you have to do is just put in Rob Brunet, and you're going to find it. It's going to pop up for you. Terry, you are also very active on the web, so tell everybody where we can find you.
You can find me at terryshames.com, and you can find me on Facebook under Terry Shames, and you can find me on Twitter at Terry Shames. And I also have other social media that I am stepping into, but I'm not active in it yet. Like, they tell me that I really need to have an Instagram presence. Well,
no, you
don't. Okay.
Listen, you need to have what you're going to use. That's what I, you know, we have a marketing division in this company, and the marketers have always said, just get what you need and use what you want to use. Don't get a whole bunch of stuff that you're going to begrudgingly use. We must have, I don't know, 70 social media pages in total. I can't go to a mall. There's no way. It's crazy.
Absolutely.
You know, and I don't want to know anymore. I know too many things already. It hurts my head. I'm going to lose important stuff if I have to learn more social media. So there you go.
Well,
so
you may know this, but I'm a chatterbox on Facebook.
Oh, but your conversations are great all the time, Terry. And Rob, I love the fact that you are always talking about a noir at the bar in Toronto. Do you have any coming up? Or is it too cold to have a noir at the bar?
Yeah, we always worry about February, but we're going to try to do one in February. It'll either be February 16th or it'll drift into March. But people can find that on Facebook. There's one other place I should have mentioned that, which is thrillbegins.com, which is and I just mention it because there's a whole bunch of really smart, cool writers, and I get to contribute every couple of months. But there's
very cool
always something interesting up there. Yeah.
Thrill Begins.
So,
I'm
going to ask you both to go to the Authors on the Air Facebook page and put in all your links and all the places where we should go and look and find great stuff from both of you and things that you contribute to. But in the meantime, here's my final question to each one of you. Rob, what book is your go-to book that you've read more than once, or do you have one?
Cider House Rules by John Irving.
Oh, really? How cool.
Really?
And I've, like, rare is the time when I don't feel it's about time to read it again. I think I've read it four times, and it's a bit of a break.
Oh, wow.
When I got to meet John Irving, I got to meet him at a reading about a year ago, and I brought this tattered old paperback. I said, I'm not bringing you your latest hardcover to sign. I want you to sign this because I hold it more often than any other book. So he kind of laughed and signed it. I don't know if you believe me, but it was true.
What a fantastic. You know, I once heard him doing an interview, and he said that when he goes on vacation, he likes to walk in the footsteps of his characters. So he likes to go to places where his characters are. I thought that was really amazing. Terry, you must let's forget Anna Karenina, because I don't think that's your book. And I really think we're going to give you absolution here and tell you you do not have to read it. You don't have to like it, and you don't have to understand it, okay? Just toss that silly thing to the side, donate it to the next book sale over at the library, and let it go. But you must also have a go-to book that is as comfy as your favorite PJs and warm slippers. What book would that be?
If I am really upset about something, I can always pick up Pride and Prejudice. It's such
there
a wonderful book. It's so funny.
There you go.
And it's so serious.
There you go.
But I also have read 100 Years of Solitude four times.
Wow. Really? Wow.
It's an absolutely stunning book. Yeah.
Yes, it is. but not one. I don't think I could read it more than one time. That's magnificent.
The second time you read it, you really understand it, and the third time you start to appreciate it, and then the fourth time you just feel like
you actually get
an old friend
out of it, right?
Yeah. It's an amazing book.
I have a couple books that are my go-to books to read out loud, because I love doing that with well-written prose. So anything by William Kent Kruger, particularly A Word of Grace, I think is magnificent. But my most favorite go-to book to read out loud is The Prince of Tides, because to me, that book is so exquisitely written. It is so poetic in its narrative that the words are like honey. And they taste that way.
It's a wonderful book. Yes, it's a wonderful book. Yeah. Yeah.
And then I like another book by Trevanian, who wrote a book called Shibumi, and that's always my go-to spy novel that got me started reading spy thrillers. So I like Lie Down with Lions by Ken Follett, which I have read. I can't tell you how many times I've read all these books. And my new favorite romance that came out this summer, and I've read already four times, is by Susan Elizabeth Phillips, who wrote First Star I See Tonight. Don't ask me why I like that book so much. I cannot tell you, except that her dialogue is so witty and so snappy. She actually won the network's Romance of the Year award for that book. So I understand when you have beloved books for fantasy science fiction, Uprooted by Naomi Novik. I've read that four times already. It was, as much as it is a fantasy sci-fi book, I think it spoke to family and friends, relationships between perceived enemies and friends, your fears, your strengths, and all. I thought it was just a brilliant book.
Have you read the Justin Cronin books?
I have read the Justin Cronin books. And I have no interest to read them more than once because I'm overwhelmed by them.
They're overwhelming.
You know? They are. In the meantime, I cannot thank both you, Terry Shames, and you, Rob Brunet, for being so fantastic tonight on Authors on the Air and making it such a joy to listen to. I can't thank you enough. Thank you.
Having us. And Rob, so thank you so much for your wonderful questions, and it's wonderful to just talk to you.
Oh, I'm just thrilled to bits that I got to talk to you sooner than having to wait till next year or later this year.
Let's have you come back sometime then, okay? So,
thank you.
Rob, you're going to come back one day and be my guest, and maybe we'll have Terry come in and be my co-host one day.
Ooh,
wouldn't
that
be fun to table turn?
Look
how about
Rob.
That? There you go. I just want to briefly make an announcement that tomorrow night, Nasty Women January Female Crime Fiction Writers Month continues with the wonderful Laura Benedict. So we'll be on live at 9 o'clock tomorrow. In the meantime, Happy New Year, Terry and Rob, and thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Have a good night. Good night. Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that's it for tonight, friends. I'm so glad that you tuned in. What a magnificent show. Thank you so much to Terry and Rob and to you listeners. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night.